particles, heading in opposite directions around the Large Hadron Collider, will bang into each other, the first pass imagines that they hit once and ricochet, where hit doesn't mean they directly touch, but rather that a single force-carrying bullet, such as a photon, flies from one and is absorbed by the other. The second pass takes into account the chance that the particles hit each other twice. Two photons are fired between them. The third pass modifies the previous two by accounting for the chance of the particles hitting each other three times, and so on. As with the lottery, this perturbative approach works well if the chance of an ever greater number of particle interactions, like the chance of an ever greater number of lottery wins, drops precipitously. For the lottery, the drop-off is determined by each successive win coming with a factor of 1 in a billion. In the physics example, it's determined by each successive hit coming with a numerical factor called a coupling constant, whose value captures the likelihood that one particle will fire a force-carrying bullet and that the second particle will receive it. For particles such as electrons, governed by the electromagnetic force, experimental measurements have determined that the coupling constant associated with photon bullets is about 0.0073. For neutrinos, governed by the weak nuclear force, the coupling constant is about 10 to the minus 6. For quarks, components of protons that are racing around the Large Hadron Collider and whose interactions are governed by the strong nuclear force, the coupling constant is somewhat less than 1. These numbers are not as small as the lottery's 1 in a billion, but if, for example, we multiply 0.0073 by itself, the result quickly becomes minuscule. After one iteration, it's about 0.0000533. After two, it's about 0.00000389. This explains why theorists only rarely go to the trouble of accounting for electrons hitting each other numerous times. The calculations involving many hits are exceedingly intricate to carry out, and the resulting contributions are so terribly tiny that you can stop at just a few photons fired and still get an extraordinarily accurate answer. To be sure, physicists would love to have exact results, but for many calculations, the mathematics proves too difficult, so the perturbative approach is the best we can do. Fortunately, for small enough coupling constants, the approximate calculations can yield predictions that agree extremely well with experiment. A similar perturbative approach has long been a mainstay of string theory research. The theory contains a number called the string coupling constant, or string coupling for short, that governs the chance that one string bumps off another. If the theory proves correct, the string coupling may one day also be measured, much like the couplings enumerated earlier. But since such a measurement is at present purely hypothetical, the value of the string coupling is a complete unknown. Over the past few decades, with no guidance from experiment, string theorists have made the key assumption that the string coupling is a small number. To some extent, this has been like the drunkard looking for his keys under a lamppost, because a small string coupling allows physicists to shine the bright lights of perturbative analysis on their calculations. Since many successful approaches prior to string theory do have a small coupling, a more favorable version of the analogy notes that the drunkard has been justifiably emboldened by frequently finding his keys in the very location that's illuminated. Either way, the assumption has made possible a vast collection of mathematical calculations that have not only clarified the basic processes of how one string interacts with another, but have also revealed much about the fundamental equations underlying the subject. If the string coupling is small, these approximate calculations are expected to accurately reflect the physics of string theory. But what if it isn't? Unlike what we found with the lottery and with colliding electrons, a large string coupling would mean that successive refinements to first pass approximations would yield ever larger contributions, so you'd never be justified in stopping a calculation. The thousands of calculations that have used the perturbative scheme would be baseless. Years of research would collapse. Adding to the concerns, even with a small yet moderate string coupling, you might also worry that your approximations, at least in some circumstances, we're overlooking subtle yet vital physical phenomena, like the raindrop that hits the boulder. Through the early 1990s, not much could be said about these pesky questions. By the second half of that decade, the silence gave way to a clamor of insight. Researchers found new mathematical methods that could outflank the perturbative approximations by leveraging something called duality. Duality. In the 1980s, theorists realized that there was not one string theory, but rather five different versions, to which they gave the catchy names Type 1, Type 2A, Type 2B, Heterodic O, and Heterodic E. I've not yet mentioned this complication because although calculations established that the theories differ in detail, all five include the same gross features, vibrating strings, and extraspatial dimensions on which we've so far focused. But we're now at a point where the five variations on the string theory theme come to the fore. For many years, physicists had relied on perturbative methods to analyze each of the string theories. When working with the type 1 string theory, they assumed its coupling was small and pressed on with multi-pass calculations similar to what Ralph and Alice did in the lottery analysis. When working with the heterodic O or any of the other string theories, they did the same. But outside of this restricted domain of small string couplings, researchers could do nothing more than shrug, throw up their hands, and admit that the math they were using was too feeble to provide any reliable insight. Until, that is, the spring of 1995, when Edward Witten rocked the string theory community with a series of stunning results. Drawing on the insights of scientists including Joe Polchinski, Michael Duff, Paul Townsend, Chris Hull, John Schwartz, Ashok Sen, and many others, Witten provided strong evidence that string theorists could safely navigate beyond the shores of small couplings. The central idea was simple and powerful. Witten argued that when the coupling constant in any one formulation of string theory is dialed ever larger, the theory, remarkably, steadily morphs into something thoroughly familiar, one of the other formulations of string theory, but with a coupling constant that's dialed ever smaller. For example, when the type 1 string coupling is large, it transforms into the heterodic O string theory with a coupling that's small, which means that the five string theories are not different after all. Each appears different when examined in a limited context, small values of its particular coupling constant, but when this restriction is lifted, each string theory transforms into the others. I recently encountered a splendid graphic that, from close up, looks like Albert Einstein, with a bit more distance becomes ambiguous, and from far away resolves into Marilyn Monroe. If you saw only the images that come into focus at the two extremes, you'd have every reason to think you were looking at two separate pictures. But if you steadily examine the image through the range of intermediate distances, you unexpectedly find that Einstein and Monroe are aspects of a single portrait. Similarly, an examination of two string theories, in the extreme case when each has a small coupling, reveals that they're as different as Albert and Marilyn. If you stop there, as for years string theorists did, you'd conclude that you were studying two separate theories. But if you examine the theories as their couplings are varied over the range of intermediate values, you find that, like Albert turning into Marilyn, each theory gradually morphs into the other. The morphing from Einstein to Monroe is amusing. The morphing of one string theory into another is transformative. It implies that if perturbative calculations in one string theory can't be undertaken because that theory's coupling is too large, the calculations can be faithfully translated into the language of another formulation of string theory, one in which a perturbative approach succeeds because the coupling is small. Physicists call the transition between naively distinct theories duality. It has become one of the most pervasive themes in modern string theory research. By providing two mathematical descriptions of one and the same physics, duality doubles our calculational arsenal. Calculations that are impossibly difficult from one perspective become perfectly doable from another. Witten argued, and others have since filled in important details, that all five string theories are linked through a network of such dualities. Their overarching union, called M-theory, we'll see why in a moment, combines insights from all five formulations stitched together through the various duality relationships to gain a far more refined understanding of each. One such insight, central to the theme we're pursuing, showed that there's much more to string theory than strings. Brains. When I started studying string theory, I asked the very question that many in the years since have asked me. Why are strings considered so special? Why focus solely on fundamental ingredients that have only length? After all, the theory itself requires that the arena within which its ingredients exist, the spatial universe, has nine dimensions. So why not consider entities shaped like two-dimensional sheets or three-dimensional blobs or their higher dimensional cousins? The answer I learned as a graduate student in the 1980s and explained frequently when I lectured on the subject through the mid-1990s, was that the mathematics describing fundamental constituents with more than one spatial dimension suffered from fatal inconsistencies, such as quantum processes that would have negative probabilities, a meaningless mathematical result. But when the same mathematics was applied to strings, the inconsistencies canceled themselves out, leaving a cogent description. Strings were definitely in a class of their own. Or so it seemed. Armed with the newfound calculational methods, physicists started analyzing their equations much more precisely and produced a range of unexpected results. One of the most surprising established that the rationale for excluding anything but strings was rickety. Theorists realized that the mathematical problems encountered when studying higher dimensional ingredients such as disks and blobs were artifacts of the approximations being used. Using the more precise methods, a small army of theorists established that ingredients with various numbers of spatial dimensions do lurk in string theory's mathematical shadows. The perturbative techniques were too coarse to expose these ingredients, but the new methods finally could. By the late 1990s, it was abundantly clear that string theory was not just a theory that contained strings. The analyses revealed objects shaped like frisbees or flying carpets with two spatial dimensions, membranes, one meaning of the M of M theory, also called two brains. But there was more. The analyses revealed objects with three spatial dimensions, so-called three brains, objects with four spatial dimensions, four brains, and so on, all the way up to nine brains. The mathematics made clear that all of these entities could vibrate and wiggle, much like strings. Indeed, in this context, strings are best thought of as one brains, a single entry on an unexpectedly long list of the theory's basic building blocks. An allied revelation, just as flabbergasting to those who'd spent the better part of their professional lives working on the subject, was that the number of spatial dimensions the theory requires is not actually nine. It's 10. And if we fold in the dimension of time, the total number of space-time dimensions is 11. How could this be? Remember the D-10 times trouble consideration recounted in Chapter 4, underlying the conclusion that string theory needs 10 space-time dimensions. The mathematical analysis that produced that equation was, once again, based on a perturbative approximation scheme that assumed the string coupling was small. Surprise, surprise, that approximation missed one of the theory's spatial dimensions. The reason Witten showed is that the size of the string coupling directly controls the size of the hitherto unknown 10th spatial dimension. By taking the coupling small, researchers had unwittingly made the spatial dimension small too, so small as to be invisible to the mathematics itself. The more precise methods rectified this failing, revealing a string or M-theory universe with 10 dimensions of space and one of time for a total of 11 space-time dimensions. I remember well the dazed and wide-eyed looks everywhere at the International String Theory Conference held at the University of Southern California in 1995, at which Witten first announced some of these results, the first shot in what is now called the second string theory revolution. The first revolution was the 1984 results of John Schwartz and Michael Green, which launched the modern version of the subject. For the multiverse story, it is the brains that are central. Using them, researchers have been led by the hand to another variety of parallel universes. Brains and parallel worlds. We typically imagine that strings are ultra small. That very feature makes testing the theory such a challenge. However, I noted in Chapter 4 that strings are not necessarily minute. Rather, a string's length is controlled by its energy. The energies associated with the masses of electrons, quarks, and other known particles are so tiny that the corresponding strings would indeed be minuscule. But inject enough energy into a string, and you could cause it to stretch large. We don't have anywhere near the capacity to do this here on Earth, but that's a limitation of our technological development. If string theory is right, an advanced civilization would be able to pump strings up to whatever size it liked. Natural cosmological phenomena also have the capacity to produce long strings. For example, strings can wrap around a portion of space and get caught up in the cosmological expansion, stretching long in the process. One of the possible experimental signatures outlined in Chapter 4 looks for gravitational waves that such long strings may emit as they vibrate far away in space. Like strings, higher dimensional brains can be big. And this opens up a wholly new way in which string theory can describe the cosmos. To grasp what I mean, picture first a long string, as long as an overhead electric cable that runs as far as the eye can see. Next, picture a large tube brain, like an enormous tablecloth or a gargantuan flag whose surface extends indefinitely. These are both easy to visualize because we can picture them located within the three dimensions of common experience. If a three brain is enormous, perhaps infinitely big, the situation changes. A three brain of this sort would fill the space we occupy, like water filling a huge fish tank. Such ubiquity suggests that rather than think of the three brain as an object that happens to be situated within our three spatial dimensions, we should envision it as the very substrate of space itself. Just as fish inhabit the water, we would inhabit a space-filling three brain. Space, at least the space we directly inhabit, would be far more corporeal than generally imagined. Space would be a thing, an object, an entity, a three brain. As we run and walk, as we live and breathe, we move in and through a three brain. String theorists call this the brain world scenario. It is here that parallel universes make their stringy entrance. I've been focusing on the relationship between three brains and three spatial dimensions because I wanted to make contact with the familiar domain of everyday reality. But in string theory, there are more than just three spatial dimensions, and a higher dimensional expanse offers ample room for more than one three brain. Starting conservatively, imagine there are two enormous three brains. You may find it difficult to picture this. I certainly do. Evolution has prepared us to identify objects, those presenting opportunity as well as danger, that sit squarely within three-dimensional space. Consequently, although we can easily picture two ordinary three-dimensional objects inhabiting a region of space, few of us can picture two coexisting but separate three-dimensional entities, each of which could fully fill three-dimensional space. For ease in discussing the brain world scenario, then, let's suppress one spatial dimension in our visualizations and think about life on a giant two-brain. And for a definite mental image, think of the two-brain as a giant, extraordinarily thin slice of bread. To use this metaphor effectively, imagine that the slice of bread includes the entirety of what we've traditionally called the universe. The Orion, Horsehead, and Crab Nebulae, the entire Milky Way, the Andromeda, Sombrero, and Whirlpool galaxies, and so on. Everything within our three-dimensional spatial expanse, however distant. To visualize a second three brain, we just need to picture a second enormous slice of bread. Where? place it next to ours, just shift it slightly away in the extra dimensions. To visualize three or four or any other number of three brains is equally easy. Just add slices to the cosmic loaf. And while the loaf metaphor emphasizes a collection of brains all aligned with one another, it's easy to imagine yet more general possibilities. The brains can be oriented any which way. Brains of any other dimensionality, higher or lower, can be included just the same. The same fundamental laws of physics apply all across the collection of brains, since they all emerge from a single theory, string M theory. But much as with the bubble universes in the inflationary multiverse, environmental details such as the value of this or that field permeating a brain, or even the number of spatial dimensions defining a brain, can profoundly affect its physical features. Some brain worlds might be much like our own, filled with galaxies, stars, and planets, while others might be very different. On one or more of those brains, there might be self-aware beings who, like us, once thought that their slice, their expanse of space, was the entirety of the cosmos. In string theory's brain world scenario, we would now recognize this as a parochial perspective. In the brain world scenario, our universe is just one of many that populate the brain multiverse. When the brain multiverse was first floated in the string theory community, the immediate response focused on an obvious question. If there are giant brains right next door, entire parallel universes hovering nearby, like slices of rye cozying up to their neighbors, why don't we see them? Sticky brains and gravity's tentacles. Strings come in two shapes, loops and snippets. I haven't addressed this distinction because it's not essential for understanding many of the theory's overarching features. But for brain worlds, the distinction between loops and snippets is crucial, and a simple question reveals why. Can strings fly off a brain? The answer, a loop can, a snippet can't. As first realized by renowned string theorist Joe Polchinski, it all has to do with the endpoints of a string snippet. The equations that convinced physicists that brains were part of string theory also revealed that strings and brains have a particularly intimate relationship. Brains are the only locations where the endpoints of string snippets can reside. The math showed that if you try to remove a string's endpoint from a brain, you are attempting the impossible, like seeking to make pi smaller or the square root of 2 bigger. Physically, it's like trying to remove the north or south pole from the ends of a bar magnet. It just can't be done. String snippets can freely move within and through a brain, effortlessly gliding from here to there, but they can't leave it. If these ideas are more than just interesting mathematics, and we are in fact all living on a brain, you're right now directly experiencing the vice-like grip our brain exerts on string endpoints. Try to jump off our three brain. Try again, harder. I suspect you're still here. In a brain world, the strings that make up you and the rest of ordinary matter are snippets. While you can jump up and down, throw a baseball from first to second, and send a sound wave from radio to ear, all with absolutely no resistance from the brain, you can't depart the brain. When you try to jump off, the endpoints of your string snippets anchor you to the brain unalterably. Our reality could be a floating slab in a higher dimensional expanse, but we'd be permanently imprisoned, unable to venture out and explore the grander cosmos. The same picture holds for the particles that transmit the three non-gravitational forces. The analysis shows that they too arise from string snippets. Most notable among these are photons, the purveyors of the electromagnetic force. Visible light, which is a stream of photons, can therefore travel freely through the brain, say from the Andromeda Galaxy to the Wilson Observatory. But it too is unable to escape. Another brain world could be hovering millimeters away, but because light can't travel across the gap, we would never see the slightest hint of its presence. The one force that's different in this regard is gravity. The distinguishing feature of gravitons, noted in Chapter 4, is that they have spin 2, twice that of the particles arising from string snippets, such as photons, that convey the non-gravitational forces. That gravitons have twice the spin of an individual string snippet means you can think of gravitons as being built of two such snippets, the two ends of one melding with those of the other, yielding a loop. And since loops have no endpoints, brains can't trap them. Gravitons can therefore leave and re-enter a brain world. In a brain world scenario, then, gravity provides our only means of probing beyond our three-dimensional spatial expanse. This realization plays a central role in some of the potential tests of string theory mentioned in Chapter 4. In the 1980s and 1990s, before brains entered the picture, physicists imagined that string theory's extra dimensions were roughly Planck-sized, a radius of about 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, the natural scale for a theory involving gravity and quantum mechanics. But the brain world scenario encourages more expansive thinking. With our only probe beyond the three common dimensions being gravity, the feeblest of all forces, the extra dimensions can be a good deal larger and have still avoided detection, so far. If the extra dimensions exist and are much larger than previously thought, perhaps a billion, billion, billion times larger, about 10 to the minus 4 centimeters across, then experiments that measure the strength of gravity, described in Chapter 4, stand a chance of detecting them. When objects attract each other gravitationally, they exchange streams of gravitons. The gravitons are invisible messengers that communicate gravity's influence. The more gravitons the objects exchange, the stronger the mutual gravitational pull. When some of these streaming gravitons leak off our brain and flow into the extra dimensions, the gravitational attraction between objects will be diluted. The larger the extra dimensions, the more the dilution and the weaker gravity appears. By carefully measuring the gravitational pull between two objects brought closer together than the size of the extra dimensions, experimenters envision intercepting the gravitons before they leak from our brain. If so, the experimenter should measure a strength for gravity that's proportionately larger. Thus, although I didn't mention it in Chapter 4, this approach for unmasking the extra dimensions relies on the brain world scenario. A more modest increase in the size of the extra dimensions to only about 10 to the minus 18 centimeters across would still make them potentially accessible to the Large Hadron Collider. As discussed in Chapter 4, high-energy collisions between protons can eject debris into the extra dimensions, resulting in an apparent loss of energy in our dimensions that might be detectable. This experiment, too, relies on the brain world scenario. Data attesting to missing energy would be explained by positing that our universe exists on a brain, and arguing that debris with the capacity to fly off our brain, gravitons, had carried the energy away. The prospect of mini black holes, also discussed in Chapter 4, is yet another brain world byproduct. The Large Hadron Collider stands a chance of producing mini black holes in proton-proton collisions only if the intrinsic strength of gravity grows large when probed over short distances. As discussed before, it is the brain world scenario that makes this possible. The details cast these three experiments in a new light. Not only are these experiments seeking evidence of exotic structures, such as extra dimensions of space and tiny black holes, they are also seeking evidence that we're living on a brain. In turn, a positive result would not only build a case for string theory's brain world scenario, but it would also provide indirect evidence for universes beyond our own. If we can establish that we're living on a brain, the mathematics gives us no reason to expect that ours is the only one. Time, cycles, and the multiverse. The multiverses we've so far encountered, however different in detail, share one basic trait. In the quilted, inflationary, and brain multiverses, the other universes are all out there in space. For the quilted multiverse, out there means far away in the everyday sense. For the inflationary multiverse, it means beyond our bubble universe and across the rapidly expanding intervening realm. For the brain multiverse, it means a possibly short distance away, but the separation is through another dimension. Evidence supporting the brain world scenario would lead us to consider seriously another variety of multiverse, one that leverages not the opportunities afforded by space, but those of time. Since Einstein, we've known that space and time can warp, curve, and stretch. But we generally don't envision the whole universe wafting this way or that. What would it mean for the entirety of space to move 10 feet to the right or left? It's a good brain teaser, but it becomes pedestrian when considered in the brain world scenario. Like particles and strings, brains can surely move through the surrounding environment they inhabit. And so, if the universe we observe and experience is a three brain, we could very well be gliding through a higher dimensional spatial expanse. If we are on such a gliding brain, and there are other brains nearby, what would happen if we slammed into one of them? Although there are details that have not yet been fully worked out, you can be certain that a collision between two brains, a collision between two universes, would be violent. The simplest possibility would be two parallel three brains coming closer and closer together till finally they collided straight on, much like two cymbals crashing. The tremendous energy harbored in their relative motion would yield a fiery rush of particles and radiation that would obliterate any organized structures that either brain universe contained. To a group of researchers, including Paul Steinhardt, Neil Turok, Bert Overit, and Justin Curry, this cataclysm rang not just of an end, but of a beginning. An intensely hot, thoroughly dense environment in which particles stream this way and that sounds much like the conditions just after the Big Bang. Perhaps then, when two brains collide, they wipe out whatever structures may have coalesced during either of their histories, from galaxies to planets to people, while setting the stage for a cosmic rebirth. Indeed, a three-brain filled with a blistering plasma of particles and radiation responds just as an ordinary three-dimensional spatial expanse would. It expands. And as it does, the environment cools, allowing particles to clump, ultimately yielding the next generation of stars and galaxies. Some have suggested that an apt name for this reprocessing of universes would be the Big Splat. Evocative though it may be, splat misses a central feature of brain collisions. Steinhardt and his collaborators have argued that when brains collide, they don't stick together. They bounce apart. The gravitational force they exert on each other then gradually slows their relative motion. Eventually, they reach a maximum separation from which they start approaching once again. As the brains fall back together, each builds up speed, they collide, and through the ensuing firestorm, the conditions on each brain are reset once again, initiating a new era of cosmological evolution. The essence of this cosmology thus involves worlds that repeatedly cycle through time, generating a new variety of parallel universes called the cyclic multiverse. If we are living on a brain in the cyclic multiverse, the other member universes, in addition to the partner brain with which we periodically collide, are in our past and future. Steinhardt and his co-workers estimated the timescale for a full cycle of the colliding cosmic tango, birth, evolution, and death, and came up with about a trillion years. In this scenario, the universe as we know it would merely be the latest in a temporal series, some of which may have contained intelligent life and the culture they created, but are now long ago extinguished. In due course, all of our contributions and those of any other life forms our universe supports would similarly be erased. The past and future of cyclic universes. Although the brain world approach is its most refined incarnation, cyclical cosmologies have enjoyed a long history. Earth's rotation, yielding the predictable pattern of day and night, as well as its orbit, yielding the repetitive sequence of passing seasons, presages the cyclical approaches developed by many traditions in their attempt to explain the cosmos. One of the oldest pre-scientific cosmologies, the Hindu tradition, envisions a nested complex of cosmological cycles within cycles, which, according to some interpretations, stretch from millions to trillions of years. Western thinkers, from as far back as the pre-Socratic philosopher Heraclitus and the Roman statesman Cicero, also developed various cyclic cosmological theories. A universe consumed by fire and emerging anew from the smoldering embers was a popular scenario among those who considered lofty issues such as cosmic origins. With the spread of Christianity, the concept of Genesis as unique, one-time event gradually gained the upper hand, but cyclic theories continued to sporadically attract attention. In the modern scientific era, cyclical models have been pursued since the earliest cosmological investigations invoking general relativity. Alexander Friedman, in a popular book published in Russia in 1923, noted that some of his cosmological solutions to Einstein's gravitational equations suggested an oscillating universe that would expand, reach a maximum size, contract, shrink to a point, and then might begin expanding anew. In 1931, Einstein himself, having by then dropped his proposal for a static universe, also investigated the possibility of an oscillatory universe. Most detailed of all was a series of papers published from 1931 to 1934 by Richard Tolman at the California Institute of Technology. Tolman undertook thorough mathematical investigations of cyclical cosmological models, initiating a stream of such studies, often swirling in the backwaters of physics, but sometimes bubbling up to broader prominence that have continued to this day. Part of the appeal of a cyclical cosmology is its apparent ability to avoid the knotty issue of how the universe began. If the universe goes through cycle after cycle, and if the cycles have always happened and perhaps always will, then the problem of an ultimate beginning is sidestepped. Each cycle has its own beginning, but the theory provides a concrete physical cause, the termination of the previous cycle. And if you ask about the beginning of the entire cycle of universes, the answer is simply that there was no such beginning because the cycles have been repeating for eternity. In a sense, then, cyclical models are an attempt to have your cosmological cake and eat it too. Back in the early days of scientific cosmology, the steady-state theory provided its own end run around the question of cosmic origin by suggesting that although the universe is expanding, it did not have a beginning. As the universe expands, new matter is continually created to fill the additional space, ensuring that constant conditions are maintained throughout the cosmos for all eternity. But the steady-state theory ran afoul of astronomical observations pointing strongly toward earlier epochs whose conditions differed markedly from those we experience today. Most pointed of all were observations zeroing in on an earliest cosmological phase that was far from steady and stately, being instead chaotic and combustible. A Big Bang undermines dreams of steady state, bringing the question of origin back to center stage. It's here that cyclical cosmologies offer a compelling alternative. Each cycle can incorporate a Big Bang-like past in alignment with the astronomical data. But by stringing together an infinite number of cycles, the theory still avoids having to supply an ultimate beginning. Cyclical cosmologies, so it would seem, thereby meld the most attractive features of the steady state and Big Bang models. Then, in the 1950s, the Dutch astrophysicist Herman Zanstra called attention to a problematic feature of cyclical models, one that was implicit in Tolman's analysis a couple of decades earlier. Zanstra showed that there couldn't have been an infinite number of cycles preceding our own. The wrench in the cosmological works was the second law of thermodynamics. This law, which we'll discuss more fully in Chapter 9, establishes that disorder, entropy, increases over time. It's something we routinely experience. Kitchens, however, ordered in the morning have a way of becoming disordered by nightfall. The same goes for laundry bins, desktops, and playrooms. In these everyday settings, the increase in entropy is a mere nuisance. In cyclic cosmology, the increase in entropy is pivotal. As Tolman himself had realized, the equations of general relativity link the entropy content of the universe with the duration of a given cycle. More entropy means more disordered particles squeezed together when the universe shrinks. That generates a more powerful rebound. Space expands further, and so the cycle lasts longer. Looking back from today, the second law then implies that ever earlier cycles would have had ever less entropy. Because the second law says that entropy increases toward the future, it must decrease toward the past, and would thus have had ever shorter durations. Working this out mathematically, Zanstra showed that sufficiently far back in time, the cycles would have been so short that they would have ceased. They would have had a beginning. Steinhardt and company claim that their new version of cyclical cosmology avoids this pitfall. In their approach, the cycles arise not from a universe expanding, contracting, and expanding again, but rather from the separation between brain worlds expanding, contracting, and expanding again. The brains themselves continually expand, and they do so throughout each and every cycle. Entropy builds from one cycle to the next, just as the second law requires. But because the brains expand, the entropy is spread over ever larger spatial volumes. The total entropy goes up, but the entropy density goes down. By the end of each cycle, the entropy is so diluted that its density is driven very nearly to zero, a full reset. And so, unlike what happens in the analysis of Tolman and Zanstra, the cycles can continue indefinitely toward the future as well as the past. The brain world cyclic multiverse has no need for a beginning to time. Sidestepping an age-old conundrum is a feather in the cyclic multiverse's cap. But as its proponents note, the cyclic multiverse goes beyond offering resolution to cosmological conundrum. It makes a specific prediction that distinguishes it from the widely accepted inflationary paradigm. In inflationary cosmology, the violent burst of expansion in the early universe would have so thoroughly disturbed the spatial fabric that substantial gravitational waves would have been produced. These ripples would have left trace imprints on the cosmic microwave background radiation, and highly sensitive observations are now seeking them out. A brain collision, by contrast, creates a momentary maelstrom, but without the spectacular inflationary stretching of space, any gravitational waves produced would almost certainly be too weak to create a lasting signal. So, evidence of gravitational waves produced in the early universe would be strong evidence against the cyclic multiverse. On the other hand, failure to observe any evidence of these gravitational waves would severely challenge a great many inflationary models and make the cyclic framework all the more attractive. The cyclic multiverse is widely known within the physics community, but it is viewed almost as widely with much skepticism. Observations have the capacity to change this. If evidence for brain worlds emerges from the Large Hadron Collider, and if signs of gravitational waves from the early universe remain elusive, the cyclic multiverse will likely garner increased support. Influx. The mathematical realization that string theory is not just a theory of strings, but also includes brains, has had a major impact on research in the field. The brain world scenario, and the multiverses to which it gives rise, is one resulting area of investigation with the capacity to profoundly remake our perspective on reality. Without the more exact mathematical methods developed over the last decade and a half, most of these insights would have remained beyond reach. Nevertheless, the main problem physicists hoped the more exact methods would address, the need to pick one form for the extra dimensions out of the many candidates that theoretical analyses have uncovered, has not yet been solved. Far from it. The new methods have actually made the problem all the more challenging. They've resulted in the discovery of vast new troves of possible forms for the extra dimensions, increasing the candidate pool enormously, while not providing an iota of insight into how to single out one as ours. Pivotal to these developments is a property of brains called flux. Just as an electron gives rise to an electric field, an electric mist that permeates the area around it, and a magnet gives rise to a magnetic field, a magnetic mist that permeates its region, so a brain gives rise to a brain field, a brain mist that permeates its region. When Faraday was performing the first experiments with electric and magnetic fields in the early 1800s, He imagined quantifying their strength by delineating the density of field lines at a given distance from the source, a measure he called the field's flux. The word has since become ensconced in the physics lexicon. The strength of a brain's field is also delineated by the flux it generates. String theorists, including Raphael Busso, Polchinski, Stephen Giddings, Shamit Kachru, and many others, realized that a full description of string theory's extra dimensions requires not only specifying their shape and size, which researchers in this area, including me, had focused on more or less exclusively in the 1980s and early 1990s, but also specifying the brain fluxes that permeate them. Let me take a moment to flesh this out. Since the earliest mathematical work investigating string theory's extra dimensions, researchers have known that Calabi-Yau shapes typically contain a great many open regions, like the space inside a beach ball, a donut's hole, or within a blown glass sculpture. But it wasn't until the early years of the new millennium that theorists realized that these open regions needn't be completely empty. They can be wrapped by one or another brain and threaded by flux piercing through them. Previous research, as summarized, for instance, in The Elegant Universe, had for the most part considered only naked Calabi-Yau shapes, from which all such adornments were absent. When researchers realized that a given Calabi-Yau shape could be dressed up with these additional features, they uncovered a gargantuan collection of modified forms for the extra dimensions. A rough count gives a sense of scale. Focus on fluxes. Just as quantum mechanics establishes that photons and electrons come in discrete units, you can have 3 photons and 7 electrons, but not 1.2 photons or 6.4 electrons. So quantum mechanics shows that flux lines also come in discrete bundles. They can penetrate a surrounding surface once, twice, 3 times, and so on. But apart from this restriction to whole numbers, there's in principle no other limit. In practice, when the amount of flux is large, it tends to distort the surrounding Calabi-Yau shape, rendering previously reliable mathematical methods inaccurate. To avoid venturing into these more turbulent mathematical waters, researchers typically consider only flux numbers that are about 10 or less. This means that if a given Calabi-Yau shape contains one open region, we can dress it up with flux in 10 different ways, yielding 10 new forms for the extra dimensions. If a given Calabi-Yau has 2 such regions, there are 10 times 10, that's 100, different flux dressings. 10 possible fluxes through the first paired with 10 through the second. With 3 open regions, there are 1,000 different flux dressings, and so on. How large can the number of these dressings get? Some Calabi-Yau shapes have on the order of 500 open regions. The same reasoning yields on the order of 10 to the 500 different forms for the extra dimensions. In this way, rather than winnowing the candidates to a few specific shapes for the extra dimensions, the more refined mathematical methods have led to a cornucopia of new possibilities. All of a sudden, Calabi-Yau spaces can clothe themselves with far more outfits than there are particles in the observable universe. For some string theorists, this caused great distress. As we emphasized in the previous chapter, without a means of choosing the exact form for the extra dimensions, which we now realize means also selecting the flux outfit that shape wears, the mathematics of string theory loses its predictive power. Much hope had been placed on mathematical methods that could go beyond the limitations of perturbation theory, yet when some of those methods materialized, the problem of fixing the form of the extra dimensions only got worse. Some string theorists lost heart. Others, more sanguine, believed it's too early to give up hope. One day, perhaps a day that's just around the corner, perhaps a day that's far off, we will discover the missing principle that determines what the extra dimensions look like, including the fluxes the shape may be sporting. Others still have taken a more radical tack. Maybe, they suggest, the decades of fruitless attempts to pin down the form of the extra dimensions are telling us something. Maybe, these radicals brazenly continue, we need to take seriously all of the possible shapes and fluxes emerging from string theory's mathematics. Maybe, they urge, the reason the mathematics contains all these possibilities is that they're all real, each shape being the extra-dimensional part of its own separate universe. And maybe, grounding a seemingly wild flight of fancy in observational data, this is just what's needed to address perhaps the thorniest problem of all, the cosmological constant. Chapter 6. New Thinking About an Old Constant. The Landscape Multiverse. The difference between 0 and 10 to the minus 123 might not seem like much, and by any familiar measure, it's not. Yet there's growing suspicion that this tiny difference may be responsible for a radical shift in how we envision the landscape of reality. The tiny number just mentioned was first measured in 1998 by two teams of astronomers making meticulous observations of exploding stars in distant galaxies. Since then, the work of many has corroborated the team's result. What is the number, and why such a fuss? Evidence is mounting that it's what I referred to earlier as the entry on the third line of the general relativity tax form, Einstein's cosmological constant, which specifies the amount of invisible dark energy permeating the fabric of space. As the result continues to hold up under intense scrutiny, physicists are becoming increasingly confident that decades of previous observations and theoretical deductions, which had convinced the vast majority of researchers that the cosmological constant was zero, have been overthrown. Theorists scurried to figure out where they'd gone wrong, but not all had. Years earlier, a contentious line of thought had suggested that a non-zero cosmological constant might one day be found. The key supposition? We're living in one of many universes. Many universes. The return of the cosmological constant. Remember that the cosmological constant, if it exists, fills space with a uniform invisible energy, dark energy, whose iconic feature would be its repulsive gravitational force. Einstein latched on to the idea in 1917, invoking the cosmological constant's anti-gravity to balance the otherwise attractive gravitational pull of the universe's ordinary matter and thus allow for a cosmos that neither expanded nor contracted. Many have reported that upon learning of Hubble's 1929 observations, which established that space is expanding, Einstein called the cosmological constant his greatest blunder. George Gamow recounted a conversation in which Einstein is purported to have said this, but given Gamow's penchant for playful hyperbole, some have questioned the accuracy of the story. What's certain is that Einstein dropped the cosmological constant from his equations when the observation showed that his belief in a static universe was misguided, noting years later that had Hubble's expansion been discovered at the time of the creation of the general theory of relativity, the cosmological constant would never have been introduced. But hindsight is not always 20/20. It can sometimes blur earlier clarity. In 1917, in a letter he wrote to the physicist Willem de Sitter, Einstein expressed a more nuanced perspective. In any case, one thing stands. The general theory of relativity allows the inclusion of the cosmological constant in the field equations. One day, our actual knowledge of the composition of the fixed star sky, the apparent motion of fixed stars, and the position of spectral lines as a function of distance will probably have come far enough for us to be able to decide empirically the question of whether or not the cosmological constant vanishes. Conviction is a good motive, but a bad judge. Some 8 decades later, the supernova cosmology project led by Saul Perlmutter and the HISE supernova search team led by Brian Schmidt took this very approach. They carefully studied an abundance of spectral lines, light emitted by distant stars, and just as Einstein had anticipated, they were able to address empirically the question of whether the cosmological constant vanishes. to the shock of many, they found strong evidence that it doesn't. Cosmic destiny. When these astronomers began their work, neither group was focused on measuring the cosmological constant. Instead, the teams had set their sights on measuring another cosmological feature, the rate at which the expansion of space is slowing. Ordinary attractive gravity acts to pull every object closer to every other, so it causes the expansion speed to decrease. The precise rate of slowdown is central to predicting what the universe will be like in the far future. A big slowdown would mean that the expansion of space would diminish all the way to zero and then reverse its motion, leading to a period of spatial contraction. Unabated, this might result in a big crunch, a reverse of the Big Bang, or perhaps a bounce, as in the cyclical models introduced in the previous chapter. A small slowdown would yield a very different outcome. Much as a ball with a high speed can escape the Earth's gravity and head ever farther outward, if the speed of spatial expansion were high enough and the rate of its slowdown sufficiently meager, space could expand forever. By measuring the cosmic slowdown, the two groups sought the ultimate fate of the cosmos. The approach of each team was straightforward. Measure how fast space was expanding at various times in the past, and by comparing those speeds, determine the rate at which the expansion has been slowing over the course of cosmic history. Okay, but how would you do this? As with many questions in astronomy, the answer comes down to careful measurements of light. Galaxies are luminous beacons whose motion traces the spatial expansion. If we could determine how fast galaxies at a range of distances were receding from us when, long ago, they emitted the light we now see, we could determine how fast space was expanding at a variety of moments in the past. By comparing those speeds, we'd learn the rate of cosmic slowdown. That's the essential idea. To fill in the details, we need to address two primary questions. From today's observations of faraway galaxies, how can we determine their distances, and how can we determine their speeds? Begin with distance. Distance and brightness. One of the oldest and most important problems in astronomy is to determine the distances to celestial objects. And one of the first techniques for doing so, parallax, is an approach with which five-year-olds routinely experiment. Children can be fascinated momentarily by looking at an object while alternately closing their left and right eyes because the object appears to jump from side to side. If you haven't been five for some time, try the experiment by holding up a book and looking at one of its corners. The jump occurs because your left and right eyes, being spaced apart, have to point at different angles to focus on the same spot. For objects that are farther away, the jumping is less noticeable because the difference in angle gets smaller. This simple observation can be made quantitative, providing a precise correlation between the difference in angle between the lines of sight of your two eyes, the parallax, and the distance of the object you're viewing. But don't worry about working out the details. Your visual system does it automatically. It's why you see the world in 3D. When you look at stars in the night sky, the parallax is too small to be reliably measured. Your eyes are just too close together to yield a significant difference in angle. But there's a clever way around this. Measure the position of a star on two occasions, some 6 months apart, thus using the two locations of the Earth in place of the two locations of your eyes. The larger separation of the observing locations increases the parallax. It's still small, but in some cases is big enough to be measured. Back in the early 1800s, there was an intense competition among a group of scientists to be the first to measure such stellar parallax. In 1838, the German astronomer and mathematician Friedrich Bessel won the bragging rights, successfully measuring the parallax to a star called 61 Cygni in the constellation Cygnus. The angular difference turned out to be 0.000084 degrees, placing the star about 10 light years away. Since then, the technique has been steadily refined and is now undertaken by satellites that can measure parallax angles far smaller than what Bessel achieved. Such advances have allowed for accurate distance measurements of stars that are up to a few thousand light years away. But much beyond that, the angular differences again become too small, and the method is thwarted. Another approach, which has the capacity to measure yet greater celestial distances, is based on an even simpler idea. The farther away you move a light-emitting object, be it a car's headlights or a blazing star, the more the emitted light will spread out during its journey toward you, and so the dimmer it will appear. By comparing an object's apparent brightness, how bright it appears when observed from Earth, with its intrinsic brightness, how bright it would appear if observed from close by, you can thus work out its distance. The hitch, and it's not a small one, lies in establishing the intrinsic brightness of astrophysical objects. Is a star dim because it's especially distant, or because it just doesn't give off much light? This makes clear why a long-standing effort has been to find a relatively common astronomical species whose intrinsic brightness can be reliably determined without the need to stand right next to it. If you could find such so-called standard candles, you'd have a uniform benchmark for judging distances. The degree to which one standard candle appeared dimmer than another would tell you directly how much farther away it is. For over a century, a variety of standard candles have been proposed and used with varying success. In recent times, the most fruitful method has made use of a kind of stellar explosion called a Type 1A supernova. A Type 1A supernova occurs when a white dwarf star pulls material from the surface of a companion, typically a nearby red giant that it's orbiting. Well-developed physics of stellar structure establishes that if the white dwarf pulls away enough material so that its total mass increases to about 1.4 times that of the Sun, it can no longer support its own weight. The bloated dwarf star collapses, setting off an explosion so violent that the light generated rivals the combined output of the other 100 billion or so stars residing in the galaxy it inhabits. These supernovae are ideal standard candles. Because the explosions are so powerful, we can see them out to fantastically large distances. And crucially, because the explosions are all the result of the same physical process, a white dwarf's mass increasing to about 1.4 times that of the Sun's, resulting in stellar collapse, the ensuing supernovae flare to a very similar peak intrinsic brightness. The challenge in using Type 1A supernovae, however, is that in a typical galaxy, they take place only once every few hundred years. How do you catch them in the act? Both the Supernova Cosmology Project and the HiZ Supernova Search Team tackled this obstacle in a manner reminiscent of epidemiological studies. Accurate information about even relatively rare conditions can be gained if you study large populations. Similarly, by using telescopes equipped with wide field of view detectors capable of simultaneously examining thousands of galaxies, the researchers were able to locate dozens of Type 1A supernovae, which could then be closely observed with more conventional telescopes. On the basis of how bright each appeared, the teams were able to calculate the distance to dozens of galaxies situated billions of light years away, thus accomplishing the first step in the task they'd set for themselves. Whose distance is it, anyway? Before moving on to the next step, the determination of how fast the universe was expanding when each of these distant supernovae happened, let me briefly untangle a potential knot of confusion. When we're talking about distances on such fantastically large scales, and in the context of a universe that's continually expanding, the question inevitably arises of which distance the astronomers are actually measuring. Is it the distance between the locations we and a given galaxy each occupied eons ago, when the galaxy emitted the light we're just now seeing? Is it the distance between our current location and the location the galaxy occupied eons ago, when it emitted the light we're just now seeing? Or is it the distance between our current location and the galaxy's current location? Here's what I consider the most insightful way of thinking about these and a whole slew of similarly confusing cosmological questions. Imagine you want to know the distance as the crow flies among three cities, New York, Los Angeles, and Austin. So you measure their separation on a map of the United States. You find that New York is 39 centimeters from Los Angeles, Los Angeles is 19 centimeters from Austin, and Austin is 24 centimeters from New York. You then convert these measurements into real-world distances by looking at the map's legend, which provides a conversion factor. 1 centimeter equals 100 kilometers, which allows you to conclude that the three cities are 3,900 kilometers, 1,900 kilometers, and 2,400 kilometers apart, respectively. Now imagine that the Earth's surface swells uniformly, doubling all separations. This would certainly be a radical transformation. But even so, your map of the United States would continue to be perfectly valid as long as you made one important change. You need to modify the legend so that the conversion factor read 1 centimeter equals 200 kilometers. 39 centimeters, 19 centimeters, and 24 centimeters on the map would now correspond to 7,800 kilometers, 3,800 kilometers, and 4,800 kilometers across the expanded United States. Were the expansion of the Earth to continue, your static, unchanging map would remain accurate as long as you continually updated its legend with the conversion factor relevant at each moment. 1 centimeter equals 200 kilometers at noon. 1 centimeter equals 300 kilometers at 2 p.m. 1 centimeter equals 400 kilometers at 4 p.m. to reflect how locations were being dragged apart by the expanding surface. The expanding Earth proves a useful conceit because similar considerations apply to the expanding cosmos. Galaxies don't move under their own power. Rather, like the cities on our expanding Earth, they race apart because the substrate in which they're embedded, space itself, is swelling. This means that had some cosmic cartographer mapped galaxy locations billions of years ago, the map would be as valid today as it was then. But like the legend for the map of an expanding Earth, the cosmic map's legend must be updated to ensure that the conversion factor from map distances to real distances remains accurate. The cosmological conversion factor is called the universe's scale factor. In an expanding universe, the scale factor increases with time. Whenever you think about the expanding universe, I urge you to picture an unchanging cosmic map. Think of it as if it were any ordinary map lying flat on a table, and account for the cosmic expansion by updating the map's legend over time. With a little practice, you'll see that this approach vastly simplifies conceptual hurdles. As a case in point, consider light from a supernova explosion in the distant NOAA galaxy. When we compare the supernova's apparent brightness with its intrinsic brightness, we are measuring the dilution of the light's intensity between emission and reception, arising from its having spread out on a large sphere during the journey. By measuring the dilution, we determine the size of the sphere, its surface area, and then with a little high school geometry, we can determine the sphere's radius. This radius traces the light's entire trajectory, and so its length equals the distance the light has traveled. Now the question that initiated this section pops up. To which of the three candidate distances, if any, does the measurement correspond? During the light's journey, space has continually expanded. But the only change this requires to the static cosmic map is a regular updating of the scale factor recorded in the legend. And since we have just now received the supernova's light, since it has just now completed its journey, we must use the scale factor that's just now written in the map's legend to translate the separation on the map into the physical distance traveled.